This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation, and we recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and I'm in the studio with Leela and Inez. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Priya and Inez.
Happy New Year. Oh, yeah. Happy New Year.
So nice to be back in the studio with you all. So lovely to see your faces.
Yeah, so glad to be here on, I assume it's January 2nd or 3rd. It's definitely, we're definitely not near February already.
I always say that the year doesn't start until the Lunar New Year starts, and I stand by that because I need an extra couple of months.
We're still shedding, and the Year of the Horse is coming in strong.
I just the need Year of the Horse?
Yeah, that's the Lunar New Year. It's coming.
I have the urge to say, yeehaw!
I don't even know what year. I only know when it's my sign.
Yes.
Which is a rooster.
Well, that's the bad year when it's your sign.
Well,
it's the bad luck year. So if it's not your sign this year, congratulations if you're not born in the Year of the Horse.
True. If it is your sign, my condolences. Now, we have a great show lined up for you as usual, starting up with a speech by veteran Gumbunja activist and historian Professor Gary Foley at this Monday's Invasion Day rally in NARM. And speaking on the steps of Parliament House on Spring Street, Professor Foley reminded the crowd about the artificial history of so-called Australia's National Day and connected present-day Invasion Day rallies to a legacy that began with the 1938 Day of Mourning. And continuing on that theme, we also listened to a speech and segments of commentary by Torres Strait Islander woman Julie Sailor Briggs that was delivered at the Geelong Invasion Day rally on Monday. So during that rally, Julie read out the text of the original motion moved by Aboriginal community members at the 1938 Day of Mourning, and also spoke about the history of colonial violence on Wadawurrung country, the colonial child removal industry, and the relationships between genocide, dispossession, and ecocide.
And after that, we hear from Tobacco Harm Reduction Advisor for Harm Reduction Australia and Director of the Bachelor of Criminology at Deakin, Dr. James Martin, who is joining us to unpack some of the social impacts of the Labor government's new tobacco licensing laws, which are coming into force from February 1st. The laws restrict the sale of tobacco products to licensed retailers only. Individuals or businesses who sell tobacco without a license may face fines of over $100,000, and fines for the sale of illicit tobacco products are even higher. And I just want to remind everyone that these laws do not target consumers or buyers. It's retailers only, but there is concerns that it will drive prices up.
Thank you. Yeah, really looking forward to that interview. And then I will be interviewing Lucinda Thorpe, who's a privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, who joins me to discuss a really, really worrying trend that is already out and happening in the police in Australia that are using AI to write reports, identify suspects and guide investigations. Now, this was happening at some scale before, but now Victoria Police are using generative AI on at least 20% of their crime reports. So when a contact centre employee files an online crime report, they use generative AI on the form to generate a summary for the police officers. But these systems are not neutral. They are trained and biased data and reproduce racism, sexism, and other inequalities.
And who can say if that's good or bad? And finally, we are going to replay a conversation between Zan and Koshin of Uprise Radio about Israel's recognition of Somaliland last year. So this is perhaps an overshadowed geopolitical event that occurred late last year, and that was the recognition of a state, Somaliland, by another state, Israel, whose own recognition is contested. So we're going to be listening to that later and definitely something that I have not been paying enough attention to, but I'm keen to learn more about. So stay tuned to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:06 in the morning, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 29th of January. Following a suspected far-right attack on the Borloo Day of Mourning rally on January 26, organizers say police, government, and the corporate media have downplayed politicized motives, hatred, and violence of the alleged perpetrator, once again exposing entrenched institutional racism. After 2 days of very little reporting from most media, it was announced late yesterday that the police and security agency ASIO are investigating the incident as a terrorist attack. The homemade bomb contained ball bearings, nails, and chemicals, and was designed to explode on impact and cause mass casualties. It was thrown into the crowd of rally attendees, but thankfully did not explode. Police reportedly took more than half an hour after the bomb was thrown into the crowd to evacuate the area, and then subjected protesters to excessive force and a mismanaged evacuation, escalating the risk of panic and crowd crush.
In other news, Israel's prolonged closure of the Rafah crossing is deepening humanitarian needs in Gaza. With Israel allowing only extremely limited and heavily monitored movement of Palestinians, and refusing to provide timelines on entry of the agreed levels of aid. In violation of the October ceasefire with Hamas, Israeli forces continue attacks in Gaza, killing at least 4 people in Gaza City and subjecting Palestinians to the trauma of ongoing shelling and the heavy presence of Israeli drones. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli raids killed a 20-year-old Palestinian and injured others, and settlers uprooted 200 olive trees near Ramallah. According to the Ramallah-based Occupation and Wall Resistance Commission, Israeli forces and settlers carried out a record number of attacks against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in the past year, including more than 1,300 instances of destruction specifically targeting Palestinian land and prized olive trees.
Also in news this week, a major United Nations Human Rights Council review has provided a long list of urgent recommendations during the latest review of the Albanese government's human rights record. More than 120 countries issued recommendations to the Australian government, including urges to raise the age of criminal responsibility to at least 14, adopt a National Human Rights Act, and incorporate the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples into law. The review validates the concerns regularly raised by a coalition of more than 150 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations who submitted a report and recommendations to the United Nations Human Rights Council on how so-called Australia can address its backsliding human rights record. Countries also called for an end to offshore detention, stronger protections for refugees, migrant workers and people with disability, decisive action on gender-based violence and systemic racism, and robust climate action.
Finally, in headlines this week, Telstra announced yesterday it is urgently investigating a nationwide issue preventing some older Apple iPhones from connecting to its network, affecting all calls, including emergency 000 calls. The issue affects multiple models, including the iPhone 8, 8 Plus, and iPhone X running recent software updates. And, as of last night, customers have been advised to delay updates and make alternative communication arrangements. Some customers reported losing service since midday yesterday, and the federal government is treating the outage as a public safety priority. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 29th of January. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
And just before we wrap up the headlines, I just want to remind everybody that the Fun Run for Mutual Aid is happening at 9 a.m. on the 1st of Feb, which is on Sunday.
Not this Sunday, but next Sunday. Yay!
Wait, isn't it this? It is this Sunday.
Oh, it is this Sunday. The 1st of Feb.
Yeah.
It's this Sunday.
Not next Sunday. It's this Sunday.
Yeah. Ignore what you've heard from previous 3CR reporting. It is actually this Sunday.
Discredit it. Let it go. Run it away.
Fake news, folks.
Fake news. Well, if you want to hear more laughing, more jokes, more joy,
if you want to eat good.
If you want to eat good, if you want to run away into your... into your
run
athleticism.
Away from your problems.
If you want to move your body.
Move your body, baby. but you actually don't have to run. You can also walk.
You can roll.
You can roll. You can just have a good time.
You can dawdle. You can stroll.
Yes, exactly.
And rock and roll. It is at Footscray Park at 9 a.m. This Sunday, 1st of Feb. There's food by We Eatin' Good. It's free to join. Contribute if you're not able to other people's campaigns. But yeah, you can just kind of join anywhere from any time. There will be a bake sale, market stalls, massage raffles and speeches. And you can just come along and like support the runners with signs. And it is all for funds, mutual aid funds being split evenly between First Nations, Palestinian and Sudanese initiatives, which are very important. But it's going to be a really fun event, so please come along. That is 9 a.m. 1st of Feb. At Footscray Park.
Amazing. And you can find out more information by heading to Instagram and searching at Fun Run and then the number 4 Mutual Aid, which is the account that's sharing all of the updates about that event.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:13 in the morning. And we're now going to play a speech by veteran Gumbunja activist and historian Professor Gary Foley at this Monday's Invasion Day rally in Narm. Speaking on the steps of Parliament House on Spring Street, Professor Foley reminded the crowd about the artificial history of so-called Australia's National Day and connected present-day Invasion Day rallies to a legacy that began with the 1938 Day of Mourning. Now, I just want to remind folks as well that Gary Foley's got an incredible archive of works that is held at Victoria University. You do need to contact the archive to be able to access those physical materials, but there's also the website kooriweb.org, KOORIWEB.org, where Professor Foley has been collecting an amazing catalogue of digital materials and just history about the Aboriginal land rights movement and the struggle for exercising sovereignty and just the history of staunch First Nations resistance in this country. So I really recommend that people go educate themselves, learn a bit more and just engage with Professor Foley's work. Let's listen to his speech.
Hey. First of all, I want to express my deep admiration for the warriors of the Aboriginal resistance. It says to me that the future is in good hands. I may not be here next year. This is my bodyguard, Tony Birch. I may not make it through till next year. I'm getting old and I can't see anymore. So if people walk up to me today and say good day to me and I ignore them, it's only because I can't see people's faces. You got to tell me who you are and I'll be right. But for now, as a professor of history in my old age, I'll give you a little bit of a short history lesson on this day. As somebody's already said, this is the day that represents the beginning of the invasion and occupation of our homelands by the brutal settler colonial British. They said you can go for a bit longer because it's really good earlier. 100 years later, in 1888, this still was not Australia. It was still just a bunch of British colonies occupying our land. But 50 years after that, in 1938, it was now Australia. Australia became Australia, let's not forget, for the purpose, the primary purpose, of keeping all black, yellow and brown people out of this country. That's why the first act of the first Parliament of Australia was the notorious Immigration Restriction Act of 1901, better known as the White Australia Policy. But like I said, in 1938, by then, they decided in New South Wales to have some big sort of bullshit celebration of this thing they were going to call Australia Day. But in 1938, the Aboriginal people were already starting to get fully organised. In 1938, from Victoria came a group represented by the Australian Aborigines League, and who joined forces with a group in New South Wales called the Aboriginal Protection Association to form a protest against the big celebration in 1938. And William Cooper declared the 26th of January in 1938 as a day of mourning and invasion day. Ever since 1938, Aboriginal people have gathered like this, albeit originally in smaller numbers than this fantastic effort, but nevertheless, every year on Invasion Day, Aboriginal people have protested ever since. And fast forward another 50 years to 1988. This was the occasion of the bicentennial. And the Australian government, led by that scumbag Bob Hawke, who wanted to be the hero of Australia Day 1988, put millions of Australian government money into organising what they called the Great Celebration of the Nation, which made it easy for us back then to declare it the Great Masturbation of the Nation. And on that day in 1988, we saw the biggest gathering of Aboriginal people in Australian history, when more than 500,000 people from all over Australia, Aboriginal people, came from all parts of Australia to Sydney to march and rally in Hyde Park. And on that day in Hyde Park, in front of an audience that looked like this, I said these very words: "We have survived!" And looking out at this crowd today, and having been here for the last 3 or 4 years, as I said at the beginning, I'm deeply proud of the warriors of the Aboriginal resistance who can organise a day like this with a crowd like this. I've been coming to rallies like this since I was 16 years old in 1966. I'm now 76 years old. I may not make it till next year, but like I said, I know that the future is in good hands. And congratulations to all the people who've turned up today. Thank you very much.
And that was the incredible activist and historian, Professor Gary Foley, at Monday's Invasion Day rally in Nam, speaking on the steps of Parliament House on Spring Street. Professor Foley reminds the crowd of the artificial history of so-called Australia's National Day and connects present-day Invasion Day rallies to a legacy that begins with the 1938 Day of Mourning.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au. You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:21 in the morning, and I might do a quick little weather check. It's been a very hot week. I hope people are recovering okay from Tuesday, where temperatures really spiked, and it was pretty scary, you know, keeping an eye on the Gellibrand Carlisle River fire and other fires burning across the state. So, it is continuing that trend today and tomorrow. Today will be 26 degrees, which feels merciful after that extremely hot day, and tomorrow 29 degrees. But right now it is a very gentle, tepid 17.2 degrees in Narm. And now we're going to listen to a speech and segments of commentary by Torres Strait Islander woman Julie Sailor Briggs, which were delivered at the Geelong Invasion Day rally on Monday. During that rally, Julie read out the text of the original motion moved by Aboriginal community members at the 1938 Day of Mourning gathering, and also spoke about the history of colonial violence on Wadawurrung country, the colonial child removal industry, and the relationships between genocide, dispossession, and ecocide. Our sincere thanks to Amy for sharing this recording and for recording the entire rally for 3CR. I'm sure you'll hear a lot more clips over the coming weeks.
Always was, always will be,
Aboriginal land!
Right on, right on, right on. So today we come together because they came together on the 26th of January 1938. And that's why we're here. We're here because we're the legacy. I'm the legacy. Little baby girl there in the pram's a legacy. Your aunties and uncles and brothers and sisters are the legacy. Okay, so before we begin, due to sorry business and this day being so traumatic for Aboriginal people, I'm going to give you an acknowledgement. So today we gather on the Wadawurrung land. This morning they gave you a welcome to country. Pipirin, if you got down there, good on you. Maybe try next year. We come here because we acknowledge the trauma, we acknowledge the legacy, we acknowledge that these are Aboriginal lands. And we give thanks for that. We give thanks for everything we've gotten. We are really blessed people. I'm blessed, you're blessed, we're all blessed. And we are blessed off the blood and the death and the massacres and the poisonings and the exclusion laws, dispossession of Aboriginal people. So today I acknowledge we are on Wadawurrung languages, and I give blank lands, and I give my respects, my honour, my love to their elders and to your elders past, present and future. My name is Julie. I'm a Torres Strait Islander woman. I've grown up here all my life. I know no other community. Geelang means everything to me. Wadawurrung lands mean everything to me. And I hope they mean that much to you. We have elders with us today. We have the Aboriginal community today. For all my First Nation brothers and sisters, for all our elders, please take time to rest. We don't have high expectations. We have chairs over here. Make sure Auntie Wendy's all right. All the other aunties and uncles are okay. Let's begin. 26th of January, 1938. It's very significant. It's 102 years after the very first protest on these lands from Chawanan mob down in Tasmania, 1836. So by 1938, the situation for Aboriginal people had escalated, it was worse. My people were colonised in 1872. I'm a Torres Strait Islander. I understand this conversation. My people were slaved. My people were sent away. My people were murdered as well. So to honour the late, great William Cooper, for all the Aboriginal people from 1938, I'm going to read you out their day of mourning statement, and then we're going to have a minute's silence. 26th of January, 1938, day of mourning. We hereby make protest. On January the 26th, 1938, while many Australians celebrate 150 years of landing of the first fleet, a group of Aboriginal men and women gathered in the Australian Hall in Sydney. They come together after the struggle that had already occurred for 150 years. We are representing the Aborigines of Australia, assembled in conference at the Australian Hall, Sydney, on the 26th of January, 1938. This being the 150th anniversary of white man's seizure of our country. Hereby make protest against the callous treatment of our people by the white man during these last 150 years. And we appeal to all the Australian nation today to make new laws for education and care of Aborigines. We ask for a new policy which will praise and raise our people to full citizen status, equality within community. What year is it? 2026. Land still never ceded. You know, on the 5th of December, when we had treaty signed off, the same government brought down the harshest bail conditions in Australia.
Shame!
Condemning Aboriginal families to a torturous life in the correction system. Now, you can imagine that, having a baby at that time. You're already in the system. Your baby's removed. Over 50% of Aboriginal children will be removed. The Victorian government has a diabolical fascination with Aboriginal children. And for all you here that work in the government, this is just the truth. Go Google it. So before we continue, I'm going to leave what I hope will be a minute's silence, but I'm not really good with time. I'd like you all to bow your head and take 1 minute out of our lives to remember and to reflect while we're here. Okay, today, what are we going to do today? We're going to share truth. We're going to share justice. The land was never ceded. What does that mean to you? What does treaty mean to you? How will you live in this state with treaty? For over 238 years, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people have been walking the journey of equity. It didn't begin yesterday. It didn't begin with the treaty sign-off. It didn't begin with Reconciliation Australia. It didn't begin with any of that. There was an assumption that when the colonists came here and invaded these lands, the lands were given up. But we all know history lied to us. Education lied to us. These government systems put in place to fabricate fake news, to condemn a people that is already vulnerable. For those that live in the Ballarine area of Geelong, Armstrong Creek, classic example. If one Wurundjeri person could get to Armstrong Creek, to the property of Captain Armstrong, they were safe. Other than that, they were not safe on their land. The Bell Post Hill Bell, you all heard about it?
Yes.
Yeah?
Shame.
We've got a bell in our town on display in a school that was rang when they brought the trackers together, when they brought those white pastorals together to go hunt Aboriginal men and women on their own land. If you're from Ballarat and you've heard of Dana Street, Captain Dana rang the black trackers up there. Whitelaw Avenue down there with Dan and Sebas. Once you pass Whitelaw Avenue, if you're a black fella, you're on your own. There's an assumption we didn't resist. There's an assumption we didn't fight for country. We didn't fight for water. We didn't fight for heritage. We fought, we fought, we fought. We still fight. You understand?
Yeah.
This is why we're here.
Yeah.
So we're here. You can call it out here. You can be truthful here. This is a place of truth and justice. Isn't Geelong better than what it is? Haven't we all had enough? How many more wastes do we have to see? How many more times do we have to see Aboriginal culture just misplaced? I'm not sure if you all know, Geelong is based on an Aboriginal name, Geelang. Half of Geelong is place name with Aboriginal names. Wherever you walk, wherever you breathe. In 2.5 weeks' time, we're going to bring genocide of the wildfire state here to Geelong. Why would we do that? Because Geelong had the highest number of children's homes.
Yeah.
Over 50 by 1830. 50 children's homes!
Yeah.
And the Catholic Church is still running the same services. Mally now. Oh, sorry, Sarah. I just realised I was a friend's employer. I'm not employed by anybody. so it's all good. But this is true. This is why we're here. You don't have to go far. Matthew Flinders pulled up in that bay. That bay.
Alfred Deakin.
Exactly right, sister. Alfred Deakin. You've all got family, go to Deakin. Look into it, y'all. As an Australian, you deserve to be treated as though we're smarter than they assume we are. Always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land!
Always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land!
What Councillor Aitken brought up is very true. There wasn't a colony takeover. It was an invasion. There was no negotiation. It was genocide.
Yes.
Straight up. There were no discussions about land. It's ecocide. Some Aboriginal species were hunted almost to extinction, like the mutton bird, the emu, the kangaroo in different areas. Genocide was committed here. It was committed everywhere. We don't want to talk about genocide because we think it belongs to some old war. We believe that genocide belonged to in the past, that it belongs to a war, that it was created, well, it was created by evil, but it was a systematic, deliberate plan in a specific time in history. No, 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 no. In order to colonize, you have to commit genocide. To truly dispossess, you must take, you must massacre, you must poison. There is no nice colonist. There is no nice pastoralist. From over in Trawannan lands, known as Tasmania, they came over here, the Dalgettys. These are the pastoralists we're talking about. Up in Jajawurrung country, just in Bendigo, 60,000 years of land management destroyed in under 30 years.
Shame.
Of pastoralist shame. That happened here. Councillor Aitken brought up the Youth Council, the voice of our young people. I absolutely agree. Let's walk into a brighter future, but let's not forget the legacy we walk with. Let's not forget the shoulders we live upon. I can't speak for your mob. I'm not sure how you were raised. But I was raised to not be silent. You don't have to be silent. After the genocide, then you've got the next level, level two, where they start to deprive you of communications, your languages, your way of being, your way of doing. There's 9 levels of genocide to complete the whole cycle of genocide. We're on level 8 and 9 right now, where we perpetuate the same crimes that genocide comes with the colonists. So today we do stand. Thank you, Councillor Aitken. Thank you for reminding us of where we stand and who we are. Like, we're proud to want more. 33% of all people in custodial care facility in this country will be First Nation. 1 in 10 women in the big house in any type of custodial care is First Nation. In WA and NT, where they had the big federal intervention, there are children's camps and work camps. There are youth detention homes. There are youth prisons. There are youth camps. There are prisons. There are correctional facilities, women's facilities. They're not often called jails. They're not often called prisons. So, like, you know, when Cheryl is talking about that the murder of our women don't matter, the murder of our women don't matter. The murder of Aboriginal women matter less. You think about how the sealers and the whalers stole the women from Boonwurrung, stole the women from down the coast on Wadwurrung country, I think it's near Drysdale, moved women across the bay. Melbourne's born on the slavery of Aboriginal men. You know that, right? Exhibition building was built by Aboriginal men. The bricks were made at Corranderk. William Buckley moved from 25 years of having an Aboriginal family back into his colonial history, back into his colonial community, slaved Aboriginal men, took them to Corranderk to make bricks. This is Melbourne. This is just Melbourne. For my people, for your people, for all of our people, we've got to get together, we've got to stay loud, we've got to stay proud. always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land!
Always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land!
And that was a speech and some segments of commentary by Torres Strait Islander woman Julie Sailor Briggs that were delivered at the Geelong Invasion Day rally on Monday. And that included Julie reading out the text of the original motion moved by Aboriginal community members at the 1938 Day of Mourning gathering, as well as some of the history of colonial violence on Wadawurrung country, the colonial child removal industry, and the relationships between genocide, dispossession, and ecocide. Thanks again to Amy for sharing that recording.
And now for our next interview. So to give a bit of context first, from February this year, the Labor government will be introducing new tobacco licensing laws, which restrict the sale of tobacco products to licensed retailers only. Individuals or businesses who sell tobacco without a license may face really huge fines of over $100,000 and more. And fines for the sale of illicit tobacco products like Chop Chop are even higher. To help us unpack the social impacts of Australia's law enforcement approach to substance use, we're joined by Dr. James Martin, who is the Tobacco Harm Reduction Advisor for Harm Reduction Australia and the Director of the Bachelor of Criminology at Deakin University. And if you want to learn some more background about vaping and tobacco laws, you can listen back to Dr. James Martin speaking with Inez on the 20th of March 2025. And to do that, you can go to www.3cr/Thursday-breakfast.
Welcome, James.
Hi, Leila.
In a message to the Australian Senate on January 18, the Coalition of Asia Pacific Tobacco Harm Reduction Advocates, also known as CAPRA, says that the rise of illicit tobacco trade in Australia is a direct result of prohibition. Can you expand on how Australia's prohibitory approach has fueled the demand we see now for illicit tobacco?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Leila. So there's a couple of major problems with Australia's approach to nicotine policy generally and separately tobacco and vapes that have really set us up for the situation we're in at the moment. And maybe just to talk about that just for 1 second first. So one of the things that CAPRA actually got wrong in their statements was their estimates of the size of the illicit market and how much we're actually spending to combat it. So the most recent report from the Australian Illicit Tobacco and E-Cigarette Commissioner puts the size of the illicit nicotine market upwards, so combining tobacco and vapes and other novel nicotine products, upwards of $7 billion in terms of yearly revenue, which means that it's approximately 40% of Australia's entire illicit drug economy. So nicotine now is worth more than cannabis, cocaine, MDMA and heroin combined.
Wow.
So it's a massive new problem. Well, it's a massively expanding problem. It's not necessarily a new problem, but the scale at which we're dealing with is something that we haven't seen in previous generations. The two main drivers of the illicit tobacco market are, well, in the first instance, we have demand for nicotine is very strong and persistent. So nicotine is the third most popularly used recreational drug in the country after caffeine and then alcohol and then nicotine. There are millions of regular users. But what we've done with the supply of legal nicotine products is we've made nicotine increasingly hard to afford, particularly in terms of tobacco. So most of your listeners would be aware, starting in about 2010, we saw a series of extraordinary and regular price increases or tax increases on tobacco. Interestingly, tobacco companies actually used those tax rises as a cover to increase their own prices as well. So as a result of that, we now have the most expensive cigarettes in the world. So a pack a day smoker who wants to buy legal cigarettes is looking at something in the order of $15,000-$16,000 per year. So, you know, it's an extraordinary amount of money. And it's one of the reasons we've basically said it's not prohibition in the conventional sense that they've banned cigarettes, but it is de facto prohibition in that most people can't afford to spend that. So if you're someone who doesn't want to quit or is unable to quit smoking, then the black market really provides the only affordable alternative. Coupled with that, we've seen very heavy restrictions, again, you know, that we could classify as a form of some neo-prohibition of vaping products. So vapes are technically legal, but you can only get the legal ones from the pharmacy. You have to go through a mandatory consultation process with the pharmacist. Most pharmacists don't want to sell them. And the products that they sell are not the kind of vapes that adults and ex-smokers actually like, particularly in terms of the flavor restrictions that they have.
I thought the word prohibition was a really interesting term, because I guess we wouldn't think about it as being exactly prohibited. But yeah, as you said, it's effective prohibition because the prices are just too high and there has not been a reduction in smoking rates in the last 10 years, as far as I can see from the research.
Well, so just to jump in on that, so we have seen reductions in smoking over the past 10 years. And we've seen some big ones in recent years, that although the latest research actually looks like we might be seeing the first increases in smoking in a long time. But what the tax increases didn't do, which they said that they would do, is that it would accelerate the decline in smoking. So smoking was declining in the 9 years previous to 2010, when we started to first see these big tax increases, at the same rate as it was for the 9 years after we saw the biggest tax increases. So yeah, the tax increases happened, but it didn't accelerate the pre-existing decline that we saw in smoking.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. That's really important information to understand. So it's a slow decrease, and there's a heavy focus on supply reduction initiatives. Can you explain what exactly are supply reduction initiatives and what effect do they have on people who use substances?
Yeah, so Australia's national drug strategy is built around what we call three pillars. So the whole idea is harm minimization, to reduce the harm, you know, caused to individual users and society more broadly. And that's done through these three pillars. So we've got one is what we call harm reduction, which doesn't actually intend to reduce drug use, but tries to make the drug use that occurs less dangerous. So things like pill testing, for example, or safer injection, safer consumption facilities, or in the nicotine space, shifting people from tobacco, by far the most harmful form of nicotine consumption, to less harmful forms, whether that's vapes or nicotine pouches or those kinds of things. Then we have something called demand reduction, which is trying to reduce demand for drugs, and that can be done through education campaigns or through things like rehabilitation services, so, you know, quit services or rehab, that sort of thing. And then we have supply reduction. And supply reduction is actually overwhelmingly the pillar that is most heavily funded. And supply reduction means stopping the supply or interrupting the supply of drugs. So that is almost exclusively law enforcement operations. So everything from border seizures through to domestic sort of state level policing, disrupting organized crime. So the problem is that supply reduction is the most overwhelmingly funded. It gets about 2/3 of all the funding, but it is by far the least effective way of reducing drug-related harms. And we're really sort of running up against the limits of what law enforcement can do in the nicotine space.
So you've kind of explained that the government's focus on law enforcement intervention isn't supported by evidence to reduce usage. But I'm interested to understand the government focus on law enforcement intervention. How do you think that shapes our cultural understanding of substance use and people that use substances?
Yeah, that's a great question. So similar in a way to education campaigns that rely on stigma. So, you know, if your listeners might remember, a few years ago, there was the whole ICE, it's a dirty drug campaign. And those campaigns can be really problematic, because if you're someone who uses ICE, for example, and most ICE users, you know, who've used in the previous 12 months are not necessarily frequent users, they don't use every day. But those kinds of messages are deeply stigmatizing, and you can have people who listen to them and go, oh, okay, all right, yeah, maybe I'm a dirty person, you know, and it acts as a barrier to those people seeking treatment. So that they're no longer considered best practice in the illicit drug space. In conventional tobacco control circles, though, that is seen as a legitimate strategy of denormalization. So the sort of vaping campaigns that are, you know, you're seeing now, you know, there's bug killer in your vapes and all these sort of really exaggerated claims that don't stack up with the evidence. But it's part of that denormalization or stigmatization. I think you see a similar kind of effect when you rely too heavily on law enforcement as well, because you start to associate, well, in this case, nicotine, you know, a drug that it hasn't really historically been associated with crime at all. It was not a criminal industry. And I think you start to create an impression in people's mind, particularly amongst people who don't use these products, that they are essentially sort of, you know, criminal. There's, you know, something dirty or dangerous inherently about the drug itself. And, you know, and that's not really the case.
On the topic of changing cultural attitudes, do you have any advice for people who don't use, who might be supporting someone who's using tobacco, to be a supportive force in people's lives or to support the education of others as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge at the outset that tobacco use or smoking tobacco, it is associated with significant harms. You know, we know that it will, you know, on average, it will take 10 years off the life of someone who's been using over the course of their entire lifetimes. So it is associated with significant harms. But that being said, there are people who smoke tobacco who are unable or unwilling to quit. And I think that, you know, while we don't necessarily, I can see why public health people don't want to support that and would do all they can to turn that around. There are important reasons why some people might want to continue to use, or nicotine products in generally. So we know people who might suffer from various mental health problems find nicotine a soothing drug to use. They can use it to sort of manage their everyday lives. So yeah, I think it's important not to stigmatize people for any of their, you know, drug usage choices, whether they be sort of the conventional illicit drugs or ones that having a growing illicit status such as nicotine. One thing that I would suggest though is to encourage people to switch if they can from the most harmful form of nicotine consumption, which is tobacco smoking, to less harmful forms. So, you know, vaping is associated with far fewer health risks than tobacco. It's not to say it's risk-free, but the messaging that we see in other countries that embrace tobacco harm reduction, so places like New Zealand or the UK, their public health messaging is very simple. And that is, if you're a smoker, you should switch to vaping to improve your health. And if you don't smoke, you shouldn't vape. So, you know, I think that's what's really missing from the Australian discourse and public messaging around nicotine use more broadly.
You're listening to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is currently 7:48 on the 29th of January. And currently you're listening to an interview Leela did with Dr. James Martin and Harm Reduction Australia tobacco specialist and about the illicit tobacco industry and the change in regulations, which is targeted at retailers, not consumers. And if you're just joining us, we previously played Invasion Day speeches from Professor Gary Foley as well as Julie Saylor. Thank you so much. And well, let's hear part two of Leah's interview with Dr. James Martin.
What could we be doing differently here in so-called Australia based on evidence-supported strategies in other countries?
Well, I think the first one is, you know, here we're sort of in a topsy-turvy world where the only recreational form of nicotine that is legal in Australia is cigarettes, which is also by far the most harmful. So, you know, it's a bit like a situation where we go, okay, well, we'll go allow people to drink, but we'll only allow hard spirits. You know, we're going to ban all the beer and wine and, you know, less concentrated, less harmful forms of alcohol. So I think the first thing that we should be doing is doing what they did in New Zealand back in 2020, and that was creating a legal regulated market for consumers who want to purchase vaping products, not as medicinal goods, you know, so not wanting to go to a pharmacist. You know, I don't think people who use nicotine recreationally typically think of themselves as sick and in need of a medicine. I think, you know, they're adults just, you know, exercising their consumer agency and choices. So I think that's the first thing that we should do, you know, is create those, you know, and do it, you know, do it the right way, have licensing, you know, bans on advertising. I think, all, you know, age restrictions, all those, you know, so I'm not arguing for a free-for-all. But what we've seen with the New Zealand model is as soon as this regulatory intervention changed. They created the legal regulated market for vaping. We saw, and they're accompanying that with that public health messaging that I talked about, you know, encouraging people who smoke already to switch to vaping. We saw massive reductions. So, you know, in 2020, the daily smoking rate in New Zealand was significantly higher than it was in Australia. And since then, it's dropped at more than twice the rate, the reductions that we see in Australia. So now their daily smoking rate is significantly lower than Australia's. And the biggest reductions have actually been amongst what we call priority populations. So that's First Nations, New Zealanders, people in the lower socioeconomic groups. And so that's, you know, they're the groups that we, you know, still smoke in Australia at stubbornly high levels and who bear those disproportionate effect, you know, ill effects on their health. So, yeah, you know, that's a massive win that we could sort of emulate quite quickly here.
What are some health-focused options available right now in Australia for people who want to reduce or stop their tobacco use? And how do the costs compare to illicit tobacco products for people that are currently maybe relying on illicit tobacco products? How does the cost of, yeah, health-endorsed options actually compare?
Yeah, that's a great question. The government does support, you know, there are sort of quit options available. Nicotine replacement therapy is not typically subsidized, but, you know, things like nicotine gums and sprays. The price issue is a really significant one. And because basically we've increased taxes on legal tobacco so much, that has incentivized the growth of an illicit market and criminal suppliers who are, you know, very prepared to sell increasingly cheap low-cost cigarettes. So we used to have vapes that were relatively cost-effective, but the pharmacy vapes would be significantly more expensive than their equivalent in illicit cigarettes. And even illicit vapes now have increased significantly in price. We're starting to see early signs that Australia's experiencing its first increase in smoking since the 1990s. And that's almost certainly due to the widespread proliferation of very cheap illicit tobacco. So, you know, I think this has been a massive own goal from a public health perspective. You know, sadly, it was, you know, predictable and predicted, but, you know, that's the unfortunate situation we're in at the moment.
Do you have any final words, I guess, for the everyday person that might be feeling really overwhelmed at the idea of going to a GP to start their quitting journey or tobacco reduction journey?
Look, there are options out there. You know, black market vapes, you know, they're problematic in the sense that we, you know, they're not subject to regulatory controls like they are in places with legal markets. But, you know, chances are they're going to be significantly less harmful than cigarettes still. And there's research to support that that shows most vapes, despite having very, very high levels of nicotine, you know, have, it's only a small percentage that have other kinds of adulterants that could be dangerous in them. And it's also important to note still things like nicotine pouches, while you can't purchase them legally in Australia, you can get a script for personal importation. So, you know, nicotine pouches have a very low risk profile, you know, even significantly lower than vapes. Yeah, it is possible still with a prescription to import them legally into the country.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't actually know that. Any final words for our chat today?
You know, maybe a message to your listeners who don't consume nicotine is just to be wary of this, you know, neo forms of prohibition here. You know, prohibition is harmful not just to people who work in these illicit markets, you know, and the violence that's associated with that trade, but those dangers spill out and affect everyday people as well. So if we want to reduce drug-related harms, I think there's much better evidence ways to do it than the heavy reliance that we're seeing on law enforcement at the moment.
James, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Leila.
Conversation between me and Dr. James Martin, who joined us to unpack some of the social impacts of Australia's law enforcement approach to substance use, and in particular, regarding the Labor government's new tobacco licensing laws, which will come into force on February 1st and restrict the sale of tobacco products to licensed retailers only, with individuals and businesses facing huge fines for the sale of unlicensed tobacco or illicit tobacco products. And you can learn a bit more about Australia's approach to vapes and tobacco products in an interview with Inez and Dr. James Martin from last year on the 20th of March 2025. And one more reminder that those fines are targeted at retailers and not at the people buying tobacco products, so not at consumers out there. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is currently 7:59 and I am joined now by Lucinda Sorp, who's the privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. We've spoken to Digital Rights Watch on a number of issues, but Lucinda joins me to discuss how police are already using AI to write reports, identify suspects and guide investigations, which is a very worrying trend across many different sectors. But Victoria Police are using generative AI on at least 20% of their crime reports. So when a contact centre employee files an online crime report, they use generative AI on the form to generate a summary for the police officers. But as we know, the systems are not neutral. But thanks so much, Lucinda, for joining me here today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk to us firstly about what is generative AI? Because we hear this term a lot, and particularly the generative part.
Yeah, absolutely. So the term AI gets thrown around a lot. So you're definitely right to question generative AI. So generative AI is basically generating the next most likely word. And so you can ask it a question and it will pop out basically the most likely answer. And the way these generative AIs work is they hoover up these massive parts of the internet. Think about basically everything that you don't need a login or a paywall most of the time to access. It's hoovering up all of that. And as we know, the internet is not always a pretty place, and it has embedded within it a lot of bias. There's a lot of homophobia, there's a lot of racism, a lot of sexism, which exists on the internet. And the AI hoovers that up into its database. So when these police reports are being put through a biased AI, which rewords and restructures them, there's a real risk there that these biases are going to show through in the output.
Thank you so much for explaining that, particularly in, such an era of misinformation. Being able to specifically say what is generative AI is helpful for the next part of the conversation. What are crime reports? Because generative AI is, we hear it a lot, but AI in general does help us with, as you said, with passwords or with spell check and stuff. So it's not necessarily all horrifically bad, but in this purpose, when it is generative AI and it is for the purpose of crime reports, why is this an issue?
Okay, so firstly, you asked what's the purpose of a crime report. So these crime reports are the online crime reports. So if you get your house broken into, for example, or you have something stolen, you can go online and file a police report, and that then gets sent to your local station, and that basically kickstarts an investigation and sets the tone of that investigation as well. And 20% of all crime reports are online, and so that's where that 20% comes from, that the generative AI is being used on. So this generative AI is becoming an automatic part of that process.
Yep, okay. Thanks for clarifying. That makes sense.
Awesome.
And then when it comes to productivity gains, why are they using AI in that system? Is it to, support productivity, quote-unquote?
Yeah, so what they're hoping to do is be more productive, give their officers more time. But in reality, what they're doing is jeopardising the rights of Victorians, and that's just not good enough. And there's two problems that I have with this. Number one is that study after study is showing that AI is actually not making people more productive in most cases, even when computer programmers are using it, and that's something which AIs are supposed to be really good at, coding. It's actually slowing them down because they're spending so much time fixing that work and proofreading that their co-workers who don't use it are actually quicker. So there's no real productivity promise from using AI. And secondly, even if there was a productivity promise and this was going to make them 100 times quicker, it's still inappropriate to use in this situation because it's biased technology and it has the ability to harm marginalised communities and jeopardise human rights, and that makes it completely unacceptable to use in such high-stakes scenarios where these police reports then set the tone for the investigation. It sets out who the suspects might be. It sets out who they can trust.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such an important point because it can be so easily dismissed. It's like, this is helping write a report, but as you mentioned, it is not helpful. People are fixing mistakes. It's not helping productivity. And it is actively harmful. Particularly, I'm interested to know about the data sets that it is, trained on. Could you explain a little bit more about that, if possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So the data that these AIs are trained on, it's a pretty opaque process. So they're not transparent about how it's being trained. And that's another issue with this particular AI is that we know very, very little about it. But most AIs trained off a large pool and they're not supposed to be trained off copyrighted material. So that means that basically everything you don't have to pay for is theirs. So think about news as well. Think about blogs. And actually a large amount comes from Reddit.
Right.
So, as we know, Reddit, sometimes a good place, sometimes not. It's hoovering up all of that. Important about Reddit, you don't have to be a doctor to, reply on /ask medical advice, things like that. And this kind of misinformation can get into the data set, and then that misinformation can come back out when you ask it a question. And this same process can repeat when it comes to biases. So if there's some really nasty political content on there, that can then get that out, or it can just be the bias that, you know, every time in a news article, a woman is speaking, they're claiming something, whereas every time a man is saying it, they're stating it. You know, those biases, which might be even less intentional, can come back out in responses as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The subtle shifts, it's so clear that, yeah, AI is not a neutral translator, and it's generating on harmful patterns that exist in the world, but then replicating them into police summaries. And we mentioned it a little bit. I was wondering if you could talk about, yeah, what are the knock-on effects of a not factual police summary?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So as I mentioned, it can shift credibility. So when an AI introduces these racialized or gendered assumptions, it affects the entire scope of the investigation. So when the officer is reading an AI-generated crime report that doesn't reflect the nature of what happened because it's been, you know, infiltrated by bias, they're sent down the wrong investigative path, and it leads to further over-policing of marginalized communities. So any potential productivity gains would be lost by police time wasted on dead ends, typically in marginalized communities which are already over-policed. So this contributes to putting people of colour in the line of police investigation, which is subject to its own bias regardless of AI.
Yeah, definitely. And, like, it could even mean that people don't move forward with a case based on that summary.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess the confusion I have also is that Victoria Police waited months to alert the community that AI was being written, being used to write their crime reports. How did you kind of find this out? And I guess with the regulatory body, what, like, who's accountable for this? Because is it Victoria Police or is it Salesforce that has, you know, supported them to introduce this?
These are all really good questions. So firstly, I became aware of this by an article by Rye Crozier on IT News, and it was published on July in 2025. And in July, it was reporting that this had been going on for months. So it's probably been almost a year now that they have been using this software. And it was first announced to the public at basically a marketing conference for the company Salesforce, which hosts the form. And so they only thought it was worth mentioning under a marketing context, and they were doing some promotion for that company.
Oh my gosh.
Which is pretty ironic, given that they do have an AI framework with 8 principles that, you know, must be followed. I'm doing quotation marks there. And yeah, one of them is transparency, and there is just absolutely zero transparency. Like, this was operating without people knowing. It only came to light at a marketing conference. And also, we know nothing almost about this form. We only know that it's restructuring and therefore, you know, doing some editorializing of these police reports. Like, we know so little about it, and that means it's really hard to hold them to account. You know, we don't know if Victoria Police owns the form. We don't know if Salesforce owns the form. We don't know what they're doing with this data. We don't know if it's being, you know, anonymized or if it's being used to train other models. And this really erodes trust in the system. And ultimately, it makes people less likely to come forward, especially when their crime report has really sensitive and personal information in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is so ridiculous and unfair and unjust, and not knowing what it is, how to regulate it, who's responsible. And it goes against Victoria Police's, like, own artificial intelligence ethics framework, which, reading the article, which we'll link in the show notes as well, it adheres to, you know, the principles that sound good: human rights, community benefit, fairness, privacy and security, and Victoria Police is not adhering to their own frameworks. I was wondering if, you know, we've talked about the impact the specific AI police summaries have, but when it comes to, you know, police and AI in Australia, we have seen, you know, some really horrific things already, you know, with location data disproportionately, like, yeah, targeting innocent people from marginalised communities, you know, wrongly identifying Black West African people 7 times more than white Europeans. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the AI and police landscape in Australia right now, and if this is, like, a really worrying trend.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned about West African people being 7 times more likely to be misidentified by facial surveillance systems. And that is a really, really important point. So facial surveillance is becoming increasingly common, not just in commercial environments. I mean, we heard about Kmart. You know, Kmart got in trouble for that just last year with the Privacy Commissioner. But it's also being increasingly used by police stations and police forces as well. And this is really problematic because these systems, like with the generative AI, are trained off all of the photos on the internet. And there are a lot more photos of white people and white men out there than there are of people of colour and women. So this means that they work best on white men and they work really not very well at all on anyone else. And when you're doing this on a massive scale, so say you're scanning the face of everyone at a protest, you know, there can be thousands and thousands and thousands of people there. So even an error rate of, you know, just 1% can end up impacting like hundreds of people. In fact, thousands of people over the lifetime of its use. And this is, again, placing people of colour in front of police officers. It's getting them, you know, into like interrogations, and it's putting them sometimes, like, I mean, metaphorically and sometimes not, you know, in the line of fire. And this is especially problematic when police have their own history of really biased investigation, and you know, you have Indigenous people dying in custody. So it's just really important that we are protecting the people of colour in our community and not jeopardising their safety by using this biased technology.
Thank you so much. It is so important to, yeah, really highlight that. And, yeah, it does put people in a line of fire, and policing is already so horrific across this colony, and having this extra addition to it is really worrying. And before I wrap up and ask you, like, yeah, where to from here? I did want to just highlight while I was reading the article, where across the Pacific, AI corporations are creating, like, ever worse products for police use, where one of the Axon Draft 1 is a generative AI product that was writing reports based on audio from police officers' body-worn cameras. But this technology was so widely inaccurate, it was turning police officers into frogs.
Yeah, so in that particular instance, a police officer, it was in one of the states anyway, they went to a crime scene and there was Princess and the Frog playing in the background. And, you know, the AI is ticking away all the time, like transcribing everything which is happening. And it couldn't distinguish between what was happening on the TV and what was happening in real life. So when they turned out, you know, this police report, it was, and then the officer turned into a frog, you know. And that just highlights how inaccurate these systems are. And yeah, Axon Draft 1 is a particularly nasty example of police and AI use. In fact, that one is actually designed to be unauditable. So these police reports, which have been, you know, generated entirely just by AI transcription, which is quite faulty, you know, the expectation there is that officers will edit it. But there is no way to track if they do edit it or not. You know, and that means that, one, the bias and the inaccuracies, like, you know, police officers turning into frogs, can make it through. And second, the police officer could edit it to say whatever kind of junk it wanted, and then they could just say the AI did it, and there would be no real system of accountability there.
Exactly.
So yes. Yep. Great example.
Yeah, so important that, yeah, it just shifts around transparency and accountability. And that was, yeah, just to wrap up, when it comes to where to from here, AI doesn't seem to be going away. Victoria Police obviously needs to tell us more about this, but yeah, what do we do now? How do we learn more about this? How do we advocate against it?
Well, if you have been affected by, you know, a program like this, or AI has, you know, harmed you in a way, please reach out to us at Digital Rights Watch. We would really love to hear about it. This is our jam. This is what we work on. You know, we really want to, you know, advocate for stronger AI regulation. You can also stay informed by joining our newsletter or joining any one of our campaigns. And beyond that, you know, you can write to your local MP, you know. You can, when you're filling out a police report, you can say, please don't use generative AI on this, you know. Maybe they'll end up seeing that.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much. So such an important interview and really vital information. And yeah, again, if you have been affected by this, to please reach out to Digital Rights Watch. Their contact details we will have in the show notes as well. And you can follow them on Instagram. Is it DRAUS?
Yes, DRWAUS.
Yeah, Digital Rights Watch, AUS. Well, thanks so much, Lucinda. I hope you have a really amazing day. And thank you so much for your time.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me on.
No worries. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Lucinda Thorpe, the privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, that joined me to speak about how Victoria Police and police in Australia are already using generative AI in their reports and the impact of this.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. If you're just catching up with us, earlier in the show, we heard Invasion Day rally speeches in NARM by Professor Gary Foley and in Geelong by Julie Saylor Briggs. And we also heard an interview with Dr. James Martin from Harm Reduction Australia. And now we are heading to our final segment of the show, and we're replaying a conversation between Zan and Koshin of Uprise Radio about Israel's recognition of Somaliland last year. So in a perhaps overshadowed geopolitical event late last year, this was the recognition of Somaliland by another state whose recognition is also contested. So our thanks to Zan and Koshin for this interview. And remember, you can tune into Uprise Radio on 3CR every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m.
December 2025, it was a big move where Israel recognized Somaliland. And this was a move that has been condemned by several countries, such as Saudi Arabia, Palestine, China, Egypt, Kuwait, Iraq, Jordan, and Qatar, on grounds of it being illegal and threatening regional stability and Somalia's unity. And it's significant to note that following this, Taiwan has also publicly recognized Somaliland.
Yeah. It's drawn a lot of condemnations, and I really have to think that if you were Somaliland, I cannot think of a more controversial first country to try to get recognition from than Israel. There's some geopolitical strategy to it. It's definitely very controversial and not the most strategic if you want to integrate into the wider Arab world, which Somaliland is positioned in that area.
And I think it's interesting to look at all the different, I guess, takes and opinions that different countries and foreign ministers have had. A lot of people, not just in the countries we listed before, but there was a joint statement issued by a group of 21 Arab, Islamic and African countries and organizations that all condemned Israel's recognition. And there were points made about how this move really entrenches unilateral and separatist measures. And the Palestinian Foreign Ministry warned that recognition of Somaliland or legitimizing secession undermines Somalia's stability and fits with Israel's broader efforts to destabilize regional and international peace. So I think it's interesting to think about the ways that this recognition could be destabilizing and why that could be done. And I think especially so considering that how other nations such as like the United States or China or Australia, given their relationships with Israel and their own stances on recognition, how they will be positioning themselves.
And the thing that is still sort of unclear is the why on Israel's, what Israel gets out of this recognition. They've said that, that Somaliland will enter into the Abraham Accords, which is the plan for normalization across the Arab world with Israel. But what exactly the benefit is still isn't really clear. but there's theories, there's a lot of rumors. The two major ones are that this is a move to get closer military assets, that Israel could position a naval base in Somaliland for attacking the Houthis in Yemen. And the other major theory is, which was talked about a lot last year, was that Somaliland could be the location where there is mass displacement of Palestinians too, that Israel might be planning to ethnically cleanse Gaza and send Palestinians to Somaliland. That could be the destination.
Yeah. And those allegations, there were allegations made by Somalia's president, Hassan Sheikh Mohammed, who told Al Jazeera that Somaliland had accepted three conditions from Israel. And they were stated to be the resettlement of Palestinians, the establishment of a military base on the Gulf of Aden, and joining the Abraham Accords. And following this recognition, there's been no public statements regarding any development on this, and the Somaliland ministry has denied and rejected accusations that recognition by Israel was done in exchange for hosting Israeli military facilities and or the resettlement of displaced Palestinians. However, Netanyahu confirmed just this Tuesday that Somaliland would now be joining the Abraham Accords. So I think it's interesting to understand how this is going to align and position other nations, especially considering the United States and Australia still have things to say about it.
Yeah, and whether or not the US recognizes Somaliland is a major thing to look at in the future. There's been a huge uptick in racism towards Somalis within the US, coming from the Trump administration. Even he recently made a comment that all Somalis should get out of the US. This might be a part of that. Could be a part of something else, some other kind of prelude to recognition of Somaliland,
which is incoherent to understand in line with the Abraham Accords and its vision of unification.
Yeah, its stated goals. Yeah,
versus what the actual outcome is. Mm. Considering how America was really central in coming up with that.
Mm. Yeah. Also the recognition of Somaliland as well. I mean, it's interesting because Somaliland's borders aren't even really clear. It's different regions within Somaliland have different positions. It's on unification versus independence. Somalia successfully got a chunk of eastern Somaliland to reunify last year. It'll be interesting to see what this looks like in the future. But Ethiopia 2 years ago was trying to get port access. Ethiopia has no access to the sea, and they were trying to get port access through Somaliland and trying to make a deal, which was extremely, not just controversial, but extremely dangerous. Really was. I mean, there was a point where it looked like people were positioning themselves militarily to fight over it. Israel throwing in their weight definitely doesn't bring down the temperature. It's only more likely now that that this could be a potential flashpoint. This could be a potential place of conflict in the near future.
Mm, yeah, and how language of like unity is very different to what kind of healing and justice might look like for communities of people, and the way that we talk about, secession and borders. There's a lot to think about, and a lot to be hopeful for, and a lot to be fearful of.
This is a Pan-Africanist podcast. Our official podcast.
That's
official,
the party line.
The official party line is that we are a Pan-Africanist. We want to see Africa become one country. It's really the only way to go, and that's all energy should go towards those efforts.
And on that note, that is the end of the show for this week. Didn't have time to play the other song, so you'll just have to sing one yourself in your head.
And that was a conversation between Zan and Koshin of Uprise Radio about Israel's recognition of Somaliland last year, which was a significant geopolitical event that appeared to be pretty overshadowed in at least local reporting. So you're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:25 in the morning.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we're going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:26 in the morning. And I just wanted to include a little reminder for everyone. If you haven't donated in honour of Invasion Day and to show your solidarity this year, I want to remind you to donate. We've got two options here. One is the Dajawa Foundation, and you can donate to Dajawa Foundation by going to give.communityfoundation.org.au/DHADJOWA-foundation. So we really encourage you to do that if you have the means.
Yes, and we also really encourage people to donate to Grandmothers Against Removals Victoria. They do really vital work spearheaded by Auntie Rio Ellis. And if you head to mycause.com.au and search for Grandmothers Against Removals Victoria, you'll be able to find the donation page, but we'll put the information in our show notes. Now, we will just have a quick recap of what we covered in today's show. First up, we heard Invasion Day rally speeches from NARM and Jalang, featuring Professor Gary Foley in NARM and Julie Saylor Briggs in Jalang.
And after that, we heard from Dr. James Martin, Tobacco Harm Reduction Advisor for Harm Reduction Australia and Director of the Bachelor of Criminology at Deakin, who joined us to unpack some of the social impacts of Australia's heavy law enforcement approach to substance use, with a focus on the Labor government's introduction of new tobacco licensing laws in Victoria, which restrict the sale of tobacco products to licensed retailers only.
And then you heard my conversation with Lucinda Thorpe, who's the privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, who joined me to discuss how police in Australia are already using AI, generative AI, to write reports, identify suspects and guide investigations. It really sets the tone for an entire investigation. We don't know much about it, what it is, how it's being pulled and who is accountable. And when a contact center employee like files an online crime report, they use generative AI on the form to generate the summary, but the systems are trained on biased data, can reproduce racism and sexism. But please, yeah, look up Digital Rights Watch. And if you have been infected by this, please contact Digital Rights Watch or follow them on Instagram, and we'll put that in our show notes as well.
And finally, we heard a conversation between Zan and Koshin of Uprise Radio on Israel's recognition of Somaliland last year. Thanks so much for joining us on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. We will catch you next week, but until then, stay safe, stay cool, and subscribe to 3CR.
Yeah, and set up a regular donation to 3CR as well as the other mutual aids. But hope you have a lovely day. Bye.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.